Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Good morning. It's 10 minutes after 8 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joy Cardine is out this week, and I'm Gene Purcell. This hour, we are going to dig into the G8 Summit, the gathering of the 8 industrialized nations that meet to discuss policy issues that affect them, and according to some critics, ignore much of the rest of the world. We'll be talking about the G8 Summit, its history, its purpose, and what is happening this time around with our guest. Joe Greco is a professor of political science at Duke University who specializes in international relations and will be answering your questions as well. Are you familiar with the term G8, but really aren't sure what it does? Or are you very familiar with the role of the G8 and concerned that many people don't understand the implications of the organization, the power it has, and what it does or does not do? Call with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, our local number is 263-1890. And don't forget, you can also participate via email, and that address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Joe Greco, good morning. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Good morning, Gene. It's good to be with you.
Well, let's start at the beginning, if we could, and get a little bit of a history lesson. I remember when the G8 was the G7. It doesn't have that long of a history in the total scheme of things, but tell me how it started and tell me where we are now in the life of the organization.
Yes, the what is now called the Group of Eight actually began as the Group of Five in 1975. It was a dinner organized by then President Giscard d'Estaing, and in the face of all the financial turmoil that came after the first oil shock of 1973 and 1974, and in the face of some concerns about some protectionist activities by several governments, including the U.S., the French government organized an informal dinner involving the French, the British, the Germans, the Japanese, and the American heads of state. 2 years later, it was expanded to include Canada and the Italian government and the Canadian government, both of which were really missed at not having been invited at the first couple of dinners. And it gradually evolved to take up it to what it is today, which is an annual informal meeting of the heads of states. It was expanded to include Russia in 1998 as part of an effort on the part of the G7 to help Boris Yeltsin. And in the last couple of years, it has also included other national leaders on let's say, this year it's a three-day meeting, so one day will include the leaders of China, India, South Africa, Mexico, and Brazil. So it's somewhat expanding its scope of leaders who are brought in for conversations. And so those would be the first few words I would say by way of background. It's an informal gathering, mostly directed towards discussions of economic issues, although over the years, political topics have also been included. The big goal of the meeting is to produce a communique indicating areas of agreement for action during the coming 12 months, that is to say until the next annual summit, where the major industrial countries want to put their diplomatic effort, for example, in completing trade negotiations or dealing with terrorism or dealing, this year I know Chancellor Angela Merkel, who is hosting the meeting. It rotates each year to a different member. Last year was in Russia, for example. The Russians hosted the G8 meeting. I know Angela Merkel would like the meeting to come to an agreement on climate change, but I don't think that's going to happen. So those would be a few words I would say by way of background.
And, you know, the G8 summit is something that during the time it's in motion, Lots of attention focused on it. And then for a couple of days afterwards, lots of attention. And then it seems to drop off the map rather completely, at least in terms of media coverage, and until the next one shows up. So what did they say they were going to do last year? What were they going to work on? And how did they do on all that? Because frankly, I was trying to remember that while you were speaking, and I just can't.
Yes, I think last year there were discussions of issues regarding terrorism. Every year there's a discussion of the need to come to grips with what are called global economic imbalances, which basically mean the U.S. Balance of payments deficit and the counterpart surpluses in a number of partner countries such as China. You're absolutely right, Gene. It's very hard to say, okay, here are the three things that happened in the wake of the G8 meeting. And in fact, in political science, there were a number of studies that in the late 70s that looked as though the agreements reached at was then the G7 meetings were having real bite in terms of actual government policies. Since then, as we got into the late 80s and into the 90s, it has become harder and harder to see concrete action. Now, I'm sure there are G8 aficionados who would disagree with me, but as an outside observer, I would have to say that there's an awful lot of wind-up and not much pitch.
Well, if we have some G8 aficionados out there who would like to tell us what some of those concrete things are, that would be great. Here's our toll-free number. It is 800-642-1234. If you're calling from Madison, it is 263-1890. 263-1890. And, Professor, one of the other questions I had for you, I was listening to a radio program last night about the G8, and one of the things they had was this sort of a pomp and circumstance thing where each leader walked down this red carpet and were serenaded by a row of trumpets, and it all sounded heavy on pomp and circumstance, and I still hadn't heard anything actually happen. And I'm wondering if all that pomp and circumstance has always been sort of a permanent part of this gathering, or is that something that we've seen develop relatively recently?
I think that these meetings have become bigger and bigger productions. As I mentioned, they began as one evening events over dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Then they gradually evolved into a day, 2 days, and now I noticed that it is a Thursday, Friday, Saturday event. There is, as you mentioned, a lot more pomp and circumstance surrounding the meeting. There's also a heck of a lot more security in light of, these meetings have now become magnets for a variety of protesters, typically under the rubric of anti-globalization concerns. One thing I would go to, though, in terms of concrete results, we'll see what happens in the next couple of days. 2 years ago, when the British hosted the G8 meeting, there was an agreement to move towards a doubling of foreign aid to Africa. And this year, I noticed in some of the newspaper reporting, there is a recognition that there hasn't been delivery on that promise. The G8 governments are not on track to meet what was supposed to be a doubling of aid within a certain number of years. And so we'll see if there's going to be some sort of formal recognition and some real undertakings of, well, when will this aid be generated? When will it be dispersed? So that might be a litmus test for real action.
You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 18 minutes past 8 o'clock. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in this week for Joy Cardine. And we're talking this hour with Joe Greco, a professor of political science at Duke University who specializes in international relations. And we're discussing the G8 summit. It opened up in Germany yesterday to a great fanfare, as we mentioned, and also a lot of protesting. And there were protesters in evidence this morning, but the security, I think I heard a figure of something like 16,000 security people on hand to make sure that everything goes smoothly. So the protesters far outnumbered, but protesting nonetheless. If you had an interest in protesting at the G8, what might you be thinking about when you went to make your protest? 263-1890 is the local number that you can call in Madison. Everywhere else, it is 800 1-800-642-1234. And conversely, if the G8 does accomplish something, what do you think it might be? Do you pay attention to what happens to the G8? Should you pay attention to what is happening with the G8? Give us a call. Join in the conversation. 800-642-1234. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
What if...
It's 20 minutes past 8 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up after 9, Kathleen Dunn and her guests talk about comments made by Senator and presidential candidate Barack Obama on the Bush administration doing nothing to defuse what they call a quiet riot among blacks that threatens to erupt just as the riots in Los Angeles did 15 years ago. That's up after 9 this morning. This hour, we are talking about the G8 summit, which opened up in Germany yesterday, the 33rd annual G8 summit. Lots of protests, of course, and at the end of the day, what will the G8 accomplish? Call in with your comments and questions. 800-642-1234 is the toll-free number. If you're calling from Madison, it is 263-1890. Our guest is Joe Greco, a professor of political science at Duke University who specializes in international relations. We've been talking a bit about the history of the G8 and whether it has accomplished anything. And as I say, we'd like to hear what you have to think. Professor Greco, we're going to continue talking now about the G8. Every year, a different company takes charge of it, I guess assumes the presidency is the term they use. This year, it is Germany, and then that country sets the agenda. And how does that change from year to year? Because, you know, every country, Russia is a very different place than Germany, and every country brings a real different take to this organization.
Yes, I think the agenda comes from two sources. The first is the very important one you mentioned, the particular national leader who acts as the rotating president for the G8. For example, when Tony Blair chaired and hosted the G8 meeting, he wanted it to be about foreign assistance and economic development in Africa. This year, Angela Merkel, she is very concerned about devising some sort of multilateral strategy for dealing with global emissions, CO2 and other greenhouse emissions, after the Kyoto Agreement ends in 2012. So the personality or the political preferences, the concerns of the national leaders, so for example, I'm quite confident or certain that Merkel recognizes that in Germany, being seen to be concerned and to act on the environment is a politically very good position place to be, and that's why she wants to drive that and raise that issue. The other other source are the events surrounding out there in the world, so to speak. For example, after the 2001 attacks, terrorism became an important issue. The global round of trade negotiations at present are off track. So that is going to be a topic of conversation. So that's in summary form where I would say there are also the very basic ongoing issues that really have been there since the beginning of the G5 and then G7 and then G8 process, namely making sure that the international financial system stays relatively robust. So that's where I would say the agenda comes from. The particular political and personality characteristics of the host and the host government and the real world on the other hand.
You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the G8 summit with our guest. We do have some open lines if you'd like to call at 800-642-1234. As you mentioned, Professor, world events often start dominating at least part of the discussion. And this year, you know, climate change was supposed to be the thing that everybody was talking about. And there is discussion about that. And as I understand it, some developments this morning on it. But the other thing that's been interesting watching surrounding this has been Russia and the U.S. sort of trading back and forth over the whole issue of nuclear weapons, and it just reminds me of I thought of the Cold War right away when I heard this discussion, so it was like a step back in some regards. But it's interesting how those things all of a sudden start taking center stage at a time like this.
Yes, they do intrude. There is the issue of the United States wants to develop and place in Poland and the Czech Republic elements of an anti-ballistic missile system aimed at certainly Iran, possibly North Korea, but definitely Iran. And the Russians believe that this would also create problems for their ability to retaliate and to use their nuclear deterrent. And either because he's really concerned about it or because he sees this as a good point of argument and scoring points, President Putin of Russia has really been driving at this issue for about 6 months. It, I suspect, will be not discussed in the final communique, but rather will be a topic of conversation, which often happens at these G8 meetings. There are side meetings. For example, there's going to be a side meeting between President Bush and President Putin. There's going to be a side meeting between President Bush and the new French president, President Sarkozy. So I think it'll be in the air. I don't think it'll be in the final communique, but yes, it's an example of how an issue that is outside of the traditional orbit of matters of concern to the, which was, as I mentioned, supposed to be more economic in orientation, how nonetheless these political issues can intrude.
Yeah, and that kind of brings up the question of where the actual work takes place in these things, because the final communique is one thing. I mean, that's, you know, what comes out after it's all done. But it sounds like the side meetings is where the action is.
I think there are a couple things going on. First, which can be considered positive effects for a very otherwise expensive process. Number one, the communique, this is the argument made by a couple of scholars, for example, Joseph Nye at Harvard and his colleague Robert Putnam. It's the idea that knowing that a meeting is going to take place in June puts in motion a diplomatic process in the 6 months leading up to the summit in the home, in the various governments, to say, okay, what do we think should be the U.S. position on global warming after Kyoto? And I think someone like a Joe Nye would argue that knowing that the president did not want to agree to what Angela Merkel wants to do on the subject forced him to reach out to his advisors and to basically tell them, okay, come up with something. Come up with a proposal. And this is this proposal of having an informal meeting of big polluter countries, the top 14, to, I guess, develop some sort of consensus on voluntary goals. So the idea is that the communique process, the need to be able to deliver something to the press and to the public at the end of the meeting to justify all the hoopla, actually does create some pressure to get things done in the government. So that would be I guess the positive take on the process.
You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the G8 summit, and we're going to go to listeners. If you'd like to join in, we have an open line, 800-642-1234. Tell us what you think about the G8. Is it real, or is it just an illusion? Kay joins us now from Madison, and good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious to know, as you're talking about these side meetings, what is the agenda and the purpose of the meeting between Sarkozy and Bush? I'm just curious to know what they may be talking about and discussing. I know there's kind of, they talk about the love affair now between Sarkozy and Bush, that he's a lot more pro-U.S. Than the past president. So I'm just curious to know if we know what they'll be talking about. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
All right, Kay, thanks for the call. And Joe Greco, how much do we know about what happens in those meetings?
I personally don't know what the agenda will be between these two, but I suspect this will be the first meeting between the two face-to-face in their new, in President Sarkozy's new role. I suspect they will want to take the measure of each other. They do have a couple of issues of practical concern that I suspect will be pretty high up on the agenda. Two that I can think of. One would be Iran. the United States is hoping that the Europeans, because France and Germany and Britain are serving as a negotiating trio with Iran on the question of Iran's nuclear program, they are sort of the point people, the point of intersection between the West and Iran. And I suspect that President Bush and Sarkozy want to talk about what to do in light of the fact that the Iranians have really stonewalled the International Atomic Energy Agency as well as the European trio, and have gone ahead with movement towards especially the enrichment of uranium. So then the question is what to do about that and how to get Russia and China to support them in that effort. Number two, there's the question of Afghanistan. The United States would like the European countries to add further to the commitment they've made of combat troops to Afghanistan. I imagine there may be some discussions about Iraq. So those would be at least a couple of the elements, but part of it will be a social matter. But those, I think they will have some concrete issues to discuss.
And that really is part of this, isn't it? I mean, the fact that you've got people that are sort of meeting at least, you know, semi-privately, I guess, and face-to-face, and that does make a difference.
I think it does, and that's it is, especially as the meeting has expanded. For example, I noticed that the heads of governments of the five outreach, this is being called an outreach program on the part of the G8 to the rising industrial countries, emerging economies. I imagine this is one of the few opportunities for some of these leaders actually ever to see each other eye to eye and actually get a sense of who the other person is. So, yes, I think there are a lot of other meetings that are going on. For example, the Sarkozy-Bush meeting will be very important in terms of people getting to know each other. The new UN Secretary General is going to be in on some of the meetings. He's relatively new. This will be an opportunity for him to get to know people. So, yes, I think it's an important sort of super coffee club.
It's a nice way of putting it. Barb joins us now from Madison. Hi, Barb.
Hi. I'm just wondering if on the Kyoto Agreement and the comments that President Bush has made, or the agreements that he either agrees or not to agree to, are we getting a fair shake and are we getting all the information? Some of my conservative friends say that countries like Japan and a lot of the European countries have agreed to this Kyoto Agreement, but they don't really, it really doesn't have teeth in it, and that it might hurt the United States. And being that he believes in less government control, that business would be hurt by it, can, you know, by making it a volunteer conservation effort on the part of business, isn't that a better way to do it if business actually does buy into conservation, which I think they do? But I'm just wondering, do they make us look like the bad guy? And is that an unfair assessment of the United States in that? Sorry.
It's okay, Barb. Thanks for the call. And Professor, we're not talking about Kyoto specifically, but, you know, that sort of thing has to come up at these meetings. And when you're talking about climate change, as they will be at this G8 summit, you know, the talk, the discussion that has centered around the U.S., Barb's question is all that fair to the U.S., what has happened at Kyoto and the implications of that as they talk about climate change now?
Kyoto, I think, in retrospect, is not going to be seen as a very successful agreement. It did not get the support of key countries like the U.S. There were enforcement problems and compliance issues, even among signatories, even among some of the European Union signatories. Part of the problem was that I think this was true both of that the Clinton people had some concerns about the language of the agreement, and the Bush people certainly did so. The question I think that the G8 members are kicking around is what is the best way? I think there is a growing consensus that there is a problem, that there is does need to be some constraining of these emissions, and in fact, the reduction of such emissions. And then it goes to your point made by the caller. Should these be mutually agreed upon, sort of one-size-fits-all goals, which Angela Merkel would like to have a 50% reduction in emissions by 2050 and a 20% increase in energy efficiency by 2020, is that, or should one try to go instead for these more national voluntary announcement of realistic goals?
You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the G8 Summit. 800-642-1234. We have an open line for you. We're talking with Joe Greco, a professor of political science at Duke University who specializes in international relations, about the G8, and like to find out what you've got to say. Again, 800-642-1234. Joe Greco, I'd like to continue because it is the G8 right now, and that's Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, Russia, the UK, and the US. And I think Russia was the last country added to that. And as I recall, there was a huge, huge controversy about that. Who gets asked, and who's missing from this list right now?
Well, who does get asked is really a big issue. It's insofar as these are supposed to be industrial, and what you're referring to, like, perhaps in terms of the controversy, was the one of the ideas about the G8 was that it was a voluntary association of industrial democratic states.
Right.
And the question about that last characteristic, the democratic, it was questionable in 1998. It's even more questionable today in terms of especially the developments over the last 2 or 3 years by Vladimir Putin in terms of centralizing governmental authority in Russia. I think the G8 is recognizes that even if you include Russia, you're still leaving out some very important countries in terms of economic issues, which is supposed to be the meat and potatoes of the G8's agenda. And there has gradually been this so-called outreach program, which is a recognition that you better have some of the leaders of, say, for example, China, Brazil, India. These are really important countries, big populations. Now, they're not, in the case of China, democratic, and that creates that tension of, do you want to have in the room people who are important for the substance, or do you want to maintain some coherence or some sort of solidarity on the democratic side? So over the last few years, the G8 countries, and I'm really thinking about the G7, have tried to reach out to some of the countries that traditionally, until very recently, were not included.
And how do you do that? I mean, it's kind of weird. You're talking to them. They have a huge influence on world affairs and production of materials and goods. China is the one that sort of leaps into my mind, and yet they're not invited to the big show. They don't.
Yes.
That has to be a difficult phone call.
It must be kind of odd. Well, in fact, what's going to happen is that if my recollection is correct, China will be part of the meetings on Friday, but not...
But it's like you're a junior member, You don't get to vote. They send you out of the room when the good stuff is talked about.
That is correct. And in fact, that when these meetings first began to include some of the countries like China, the meetings themselves would take place in a physical location separate from the full G8 meetings, simply to drive home that the club was a club and that some of the countries, such as China, were not really members of the club. I believe that's been put to the side, and the Chinese and other national leaders on tomorrow will be actually coming up to the hotel, Kempinski, where the big summit is taking place. It is a kind of a peculiar, must be awkward in terms of being the protocol officer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where do you find that in your book?
Yeah.
All right, we're talking about the G8 Summit with Joe Greco. He is a professor of political science at Duke University, specializing in international relations. We'd like to find out what you think about the G8. Are there countries in there that should be in there that aren't represented right now? What role does globalization play in all this? Do the protests that are occurring right now make a difference in the G8 summit? Do they have an impact? And what do you think about it? 800-642-1234. In Madison, it is 263-1890. I'm Gene Purcell, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 19 minutes before 9 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. After 9, Kathleen Dunn and her guests talk about comments made by Senator and presidential candidate Barack Obama on the Bush administration doing nothing to defuse what they call a quiet riot among blacks that threatens to erupt just as the riots in Los Angeles did 15 years ago. That's up after 9. This hour, we're talking about the G8 summit with our guest Joe Greco, a professor of political science at Duke University. He specializes in international relations. Let's go right to the phones right now, and John joins us from Onalaska. Good morning, John.
Good morning. I'd like to ask what role Maurice Strong, a Canadian that was involved in a lot of this stuff behind Kyoto and other matters like this, what role does Maurice Strong have in today's meetings?
All right, that's a good question. And Joe Greco?
I'm afraid I don't know the answer.
All right, well, that's fair enough. You know, we can't know the answer to everything. One of the questions I had to ask, that I'd like to ask, we were talking about China right before the break, and does there get to be a point, you know, where a country is just so big and so powerful and has such an impact that they can't, I mean, they're making these sort of, you know, weird sideways overtures, but that they will not be able to ignore them and will have to invite them, and it will become the G9 or the G10 or whatever.
I suspect that's the long-term trajectory, and in particular, I think this is going to be true of China and India. I suspect that either the G8 will truly change and move beyond something that's kind of this annual summitry structure, or it will retain that structure with at least those two members. But there are other important countries, Mexico and Brazil, would be two that come to mind. I think there is some political horse trading that goes on in terms of which countries are brought in the movement from G5 to G7. I think there was a trade made where the Europeans wanted to accommodate Italian complaints that the Italian national leader was not invited, and the Americans replied by, well, we don't want to be so outnumbered there. We want to have someone somewhat close to us in terms of orientation, so we want the Canadians invited. Also, they're complaining to us about it anyway. So I could imagine a pair of countries being brought in as permanent invitees, namely India and China.
Let's go back to the phones right now, and Ahmed is with us from Milwaukee. Good morning.
Yeah, hi, good morning. I have a question, and I'm a little bit confused about some dictators. They are dictators, but some of them, they are dictators and they are the allies for the Western countries, like the president of Pakistan, that to me, you know, he came to power as a dictator and with the coup d'etat, and he is an ally in the same time. While some other presidents, they are dictators and they have nothing to do with the Western countries, like Chavez, for example. We describe Chavez as a dictator. We describe Musharraf, the president of Pakistan, as a dictator also, but he's an ally. It's a little bit confusing. Can you please, try to describe exactly what is an ally, who is a dictator at the same time?
Joe Greco, and how does that relate to the G8? Because, I mean, I guess when you come to the table as the U.S. or Britain or whoever, you do bring your allies with you.
Well, I think the caller is pointing to a very hard reality that often occurs in international politics, namely that it makes for awfully strange bedfellows. The United States was allied with the Soviet Union under Joseph Stalin after 1941 to fight Nazi Germany. So you do end up, and the U.S. provided tremendous amounts of lend-lease assistance to the Soviet Union during World War II. They did not coordinate closely on military strategy, but they did at least meet on matters regarding military strategy. So the United States oftentimes does have allies who are also dictators. I think in most U.S. conversations about President Musharraf of Pakistan, I think there's a recognition that he is definitely a dictator. Whether he's an ally or not, I think, is in recent last couple of years has become somewhat in doubt, but on balance, I suspect that the sense is that he's better than the alternative. In terms of the G8, the caller is highlighting also a tension, which you also, Gene, mentioned, that the G8 in its inauguration, going back to the 70s, I think there was this sense that this was a community of democratic states, which also occurred in NATO to some degree, but this was going to work on economic issues. And I think there's been some compromise of that, and the compromise has occurred with, and this is manifested by the inclusion of Russia and the movement towards incorporation of China, and I think that's in part a recognition that these countries are politically important or economically important or both.
And also, as you were speaking, it reminded me that, you know, 1975, in a lot of ways, was a very long time ago, and it is a different world. And back then, in a lot of regards, it was a lot more, you know, them versus us, and the lines in some regards were a lot more clear cut. And those changes now, you know, there's been, you know, a steady evolution, I guess, in the roles of countries in terms of globalization and who trades who with what, and countries have come and gone and so forth. And it seems like the whole landscape is a lot murkier now than it was then, or maybe it was also murky then too, and hindsight just provides a lot of clarity.
Well, there was certainly I think the G7 countries in part worked to get a grip on the economic turbulence that basically came out of the oil crises, 1973-74, then with the Iranian Revolution and the Iran-Iraq War, 1979-80. I think one of the reasons that the G7 came together, and at least at that time was actually significant in terms of pushing for trade liberalization, some macroeconomic cooperation, was because of a sense that, yes, we are a group of countries that have very strong economic interests in common, overlaid by very important common security interests. I think one reason why the G8 is a little bit less active today is because the world economy is not in the same kind of crisis mode as it was in the mid to late 1970s. So that's part of the reason. But the other part, I think, speaks to something that you mentioned, that one of the reasons why it's harder, why a meeting between the American president and the French president isn't going to do it in terms of pushing the revitalizing what are now stalled world trade talks, one of the reasons is because, well, France and the United States are not the only two countries that matter when it comes to international trade. You really do have to have China in the room, for example.
Is, you know, in terms of the G8, the U.S. gets accused of all sorts of things, but is it really always the gorilla in the room?
I think Madeleine Albright was getting pretty close to the current reality, namely that the United States is indispensable on most major international issues. It cannot dictate what other countries or groups of countries are going to do. The United States, for example, could not tell the French or could not compel the French, for example, to support the United States in the UN in 2002 when the U.S. was trying to get a second UN resolution on Iraq. The United States can't tell force the Russians to cooperate on the Iranian problem. But let's say, for example, on the global climate issue, without effort and work by the United States on that issue, since the United States is still, if not the biggest polluter, it's because it may soon be surpassed by China, it's still, at the moment, among the top two polluters. So without American cooperation, it's hard to see how meaningful progress can be made in addressing that problem. So I think Madeleine Albright, her term indispensable nation is something I'm comfortable with.
Brett joins us now, and Brett is in Oshkosh. Good morning.
Good morning. I was just curious what the relation is between the G8 and the WTO and possibly the Bilderberger group, and if their policies and decision-making overlap one another. I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Brett, good questions there. What is there? Well, first of all, Professor, is there a relationship at all?
There is no formal institutional link between the G8 and the WTO. However, many of the major partners of the WTO are also members of G8, and so this effort to come up with some language, we can expect to see something, a paragraph in the communique suggesting that the leading trading countries believe that we shouldn't let go of the opportunity to have a new multilateral trade agreement under the auspices of the WTO. And I noticed today that Germany, the German government, is hosting a follow-up trade ministers meeting at the end of June to try to deal with some of the concrete roadblocks that have stalled the world trade negotiations for about 3 years. So there's no informal, there's no formal link, there's an informal link. Where there is something more of a formal link is actually between the G8 and the IMF. The IMF is supposed to be, has been instructed by the its board of governors to help collect information on global balance of payments problems and provide that information to the G8 as part of their consultation. So there's more of a connection between the IMF on the one hand and the G8 on the other than in the case of the World Trade Organization.
One of the things you can always count on with a G8 summit is protesters. And Germany this time around has gone through some pretty extraordinary lengths, I think, to ensure that the protesters don't get through. You know, they've put it in kind of a remote location, lots and lots of security. So on the one hand, you know, they're trying to make it difficult. But at the same time, by trying to do that, it seems as though they're acknowledging at some level that these protests have an impact and that they don't want them around.
Well, yeah, yes, I noticed. I was looking at the map of Heiligendamm, which is the town where the where apparently it's the first German seaside resort was established. A very lovely hotel, and it also has the advantage of being on a jut of land that can then be easily or more readily protected. And you're right about the security procedures. Each year have been more and more stupendous and expensive. I think this is going to be more than $100 million in expense, something like 16,000 security officers, police officers, a big metal fence about 8 feet tall, which apparently some of the protesters are finding ways to get around. I think the organizers are afraid of a couple things, the G8. First, they're worried about terrorism because this would be a really, really high visibility target. But number two, they are worried about the protesters. I think the protesters actually, though, do serve a purpose. I have a sense that, and we should keep in mind that there are protests at the IMF annual meeting, which is in April in Washington. There are also protests at some of the major World Trade Organization meetings, remember back in Seattle, 1999. And I suspect some of the, for example, one of the issues that the G8 governments are going to address this weekend is the issue of trying to get more money to combat HIV/AIDS in Africa. I suspect that became an agenda item in part because it's as a way of trying to reach out to the broad, to the middle sort of range of international opinion to counter the arguments of the protesters, most of whom are completely peaceful and mainstream, such as Greenpeace, I would say. Who are saying that these governments are not dealing with real-world issues but are only trying to advance the narrow interests of business, for example. So I actually think the protesters have probably spurred the expansion of the range of issues covered by the G8, as well as perhaps the number of countries that are invited.
And it's a pretty fantastic process, if you think about it, that these, you know, normal people who are concerned about world events you know, go through great lengths and actually wind up at some level having an impact on world leaders. It's an interesting forum, and the fact that they can have that impact, it doesn't sound like it could actually happen, but it does.
Well, it's amazing. I mean, a small protest of 50 people outside a meeting hall is definitely going to attract the local newspapers, the local TV stations, and so on. These are much, much bigger, and I think the protesters know this. They also know that, and they have become more elaborate in the character of the protest. They've become more colorful, more imaginative, more sort of gaudy and sort of outrageous. There are people, for example, some of the protesters this time are wearing clowns' outfits, and they know that they're getting lots of attention, and I do think that national leaders want to be seen not to respond directly, to kowtow to the protesters, but rather to counter their arguments. And one way to do that is in terms of the issues that are raised.
Now, as we this is a lot of time and a lot of effort for a meeting that lasts a couple of days. And at the beginning of the show, you said it's hard to know right now exactly what's going to come out in terms of the final communique. Climate change is on the agenda. What should we be watching for as the meeting progresses? What sorts of things should we be concerned with as they get ready? And as a side note to that, when will this final communique come out?
I suspect it's going to be Saturday. The three items that I'm going to be keeping an eye out for will be, as I mentioned, the question of what concrete steps will be taken to enhance foreign assistance to Africa on the economic front. Many of the sub-Saharan African countries have actually enjoyed pretty good economic growth in recent years, but nonetheless, they still have lots and lots of problems. So one canary in the mind as to whether this is a serious organization is to see whether something concrete is going to come out on that issue. Number two, HIV/AIDS in Africa. Number three, what can they agree on? What steps will be taken to begin to think about some sort of reasonable approach to the control of gas emissions over the next several years? Those are at least the three that come to my mind. Number four, if something can be said about the World Trade negotiations, that would be helpful. But in the past, there's not much that comes as a result of those such statements. But the first three, I think, could be meaningful.
Well, very good. We will keep our eyes open for Saturday, and we will see what the final communique brings. Professor Greco, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Gene.
It's been a great conversation. Joe Greco, a professor of political science at Duke University, who specializes in international relations. And for the past hour or so, we've been talking about the G8 summit. It opened up in Germany yesterday to a great fanfare, to great pomp and circumstance, and also to a great number of protests. We've been talking about the G8, what it is supposed to do, and what its actual impact might be. If you'd like a copy of the program, you can call the radio store at 800-747-7444. And when you do, ask for program 67C, as in cat, or you can also listen to the program online. It's available at our web archives, and you'll find those at wpr.org. The program was produced today by Cheryl Gasser, and Leo Duran provided us with on-air production. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in for Joy Cardine this week. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.